and tenderly close my eyelids when I must take my last rest. He would work hard, he promised, to play the role properly. I love you as a father with all my heart. It is true that I sometimes suspect that heart of wanting to go further, but I try to conceal it from myself. The transformation of their relationship evoked from Franklin one of his most wistful and self-revealing little tales, The Ephemera, written to her after a stroll in the garden. The theme came from an article he had printed in the Pennsylvania Gazette 50 years earlier. He had happened to overhear, he wrote, a lament by one of the tiny, short-lived flies who realized that his 7 hours on this planet were nearing an end. I have seen generations born, flourish, and expire. My present friends are the children and grandchildren of the friends of my youth, who are now, alas, no more. And I must soon follow them, for by the course of nature, though still in health, I cannot expect to live above 7 or 8 minutes longer. What now avails all my toil and labor in amassing honeydew on this leaf, which I cannot live to enjoy? My friends would comfort me with the idea of a name they say I shall leave behind me, and they tell me I have lived long enough to nature and to glory. But what will fame be to an ephemere who no longer exists? To me, after all my eager pursuits, no solid pleasures now remain but the reflection of a long life spent in meaning well, the sensible conversation of a few good lady ephemeres, and now and then a kind smile and a tune from the ever-amiable Briant. In the original French version, the final words more clearly refer to the recipient. Toujours amiable Briant. Throughout his remaining years in France, and even in letters after his return to America, Franklin would stay emotionally attached to Madame Briant. Their new arrangement still allowed him such liberties as playing chess with a mutual friend late into the night in her bathroom while she soaked in her tub and watched. But it was, as bathtub chess games go, rather innocent. The tub was covered, as was the style, by a wooden plank. "I am afraid that we may have made you very uncomfortable by keeping you so long in the bath," he apologized the next day, adding a wry little promise. "Never again will I consent to start a chess game with the neighbor in your bathing room. Can you forgive me this indiscretion?" She certainly could. "No, my good papa, you did not do me any ill yesterday," she replied. "I get so much pleasure from seeing you that it made up for the little fatigue of having come out of the bath a little too late." Having forsaken the possibility of an earthly romance, they amused themselves by promising themselves one in heaven. "I give you my word," she teased him at one point, "that I will become your wife in paradise, on the condition that you will not make too many conquests among the heavenly maidens while you are waiting for me. I want a faithful husband when I take one for eternity." More than almost anyone, she could articulate what made him so charming to women. That gaiety and that gallantry that cause all women to love you because you love them all. With both insight and affection, she declared, "You combine the kindest heart with the soundest moral teaching, a lively imagination, and that droll roguishness which shows that the wisest of men allows his wisdom to be perpetually broken against the rocks of femininity." In the ensuing years, Franklin would help guide Madame Briand through her bouts of depression. And he would try, as we shall see, to encourage a marriage between Temple and either of her daughters. But increasingly, by 1779, He was turning more of his attention toward another woman, one with an even more fascinating household, who lived in the neighboring village of Otei. Madame Helvétius. Anne-Catherine de Ligniville d'Autrecourt was born to one of the great aristocratic families of Lorraine. But she was the 10th of 20 children and thus lacked a dowry. So when she was 15 and of marriageable age, she was sent off to a convent. As it turned out, she certainly did not have the temperament for a cloistered life, nor, for that matter, the funds. At age 30, her pension ran out, and so did she, to Paris, where she was taken in by a kindly aunt who had left her husband, become a novelist, and created a salon filled with bright and slightly bohemian intellectuals. There, Anne-Catherine's vivacity and beauty attracted many suitors, most notably the economist Turgot, 8 years her junior, who would later become France's controller and a friend of Franklin. Turgot was engaging but not wealthy enough, so she instead married someone more established, Claude-Adrien Helvétius. Helvétius was one of France's 50 or so farmers general, a royal chartered group with the very lucrative assignment of collecting taxes and holding leases. Once he had made his fortune, Helvétius set out to satisfy his social and intellectual aspirations. So the rich financier married the poor aristocrat and became, as mentioned above, a noted philosopher who helped plan the Nine Sisters Masonic Lodge. His great work, De l'Esprit, 1758, was a controversial espousal of godless hedonism, which argued that the love of pleasure motivated human activity. Around him he gathered the stars of the Enlightenment, including Diderot, Condorcet, Hume on his occasional visits from Edinburgh, and Turgot, still in favor, though spurned as a suitor. When Helvétius died in 1771, 5 years before Franklin's arrival, his widow, Anne-Catherine, now Madame Helvétius, married off their two daughters to men of their own choosing, gave each of them one of the family chateaux, and bought a rambling farm in Otei, near Passy. She was lively, outgoing, and, as befitted her aristocratic birth but impoverished upbringing, somewhat of a free-spirited bohemian, who enjoyed projecting an earthy aura. There is an oft-repeated remark that has been attributed to many, but was likely first famously uttered by the writer Fontenelle, who was in his late 90s when he frequented her salon. Beholding Madame Helvétius in one of her more casual states of undress, he proclaimed, "Oh, to be 70 again." At Otei, she cultivated a free-spirited garden that was devoid of all French formality, a collection of ducks and dogs that formed a noisy and motley menagerie, and a salon that displayed many of the same attributes. Friends brought her rare plants, unusual pets, and provocative ideas, and she nurtured them all at what became jokingly known as l'Académie d'Otei. Living with Madame Helvétius were two priests and one acolyte, the Abbé André Morellet, a noted political economist and contributor to the Encyclopédie, in his late 40s, who had first befriended Franklin in 1772, at the English house party where he played the trick of stilling the waves with his magic cane, and who shared his love for fine wine, song, economic theories, and practical inventions. The Abbé Martin Lefebvre de la Roche, in his late 30s, a former Benedictine whom, in Morellet's words, Helvétius had, after a fashion, secularized. Pierre-Jean-Georges Cabanis, a bachelor poet in his early 20s, who translated Homer, studied medicine, wrote a book on hospitals, and revered Franklin, whose tales and anecdotes he faithfully recorded. "We discoursed of morality, of politics, and of philosophy," La Roche recalled. "Notre Dame d'Auteuil excited your coquetry, and the Abbé Morellet wrangled over the cream and ushered his arguments to prove what we did not believe." It was Turgot, still smitten by Madame Helvétius, who first brought Franklin to visit her in 1778, when she was nearly 60 but still both lively and beautiful. Her domestic menagerie, filled with banter and intellectual irreverence, was perfectly tailored to Franklin's tastes, and shortly thereafter he wrote her a letter in which he described her electromagnetism. "I have in my way been trying to form some hypothesis to account for your having so many friends and of such various kinds. I see that statesmen, philosophers, historians, poets, and men of learning of all sorts attach themselves to you as straws to a fine piece of amber. We find in your sweet society that charming benevolence, that amiable attention to oblige, that disposition to please and be pleased, which we do not always find in the society of one another. In your company, we are not only pleased with you, but better pleased with one another, and with ourselves." Not surprisingly, John Adams was shocked by both Madame Helvétius and her household when Franklin brought him for a visit. "The two abbots," he sniped, "I suppose, have as much power to pardon a sin as they have to commit one." Of the moral absurdities at the house, he commented, "No kind of republican government can ever exist with such national manners." His wife, Abigail, was even more horrified when she visited later, and she described Madame Helvétius with a delightfully vicious pen. Her hair was frizzled. Over it she had a small straw hat with a dirty gauze handkerchief behind. She carried on the chief of the conversation at dinner, frequently locking her hand into the doctor's, and sometimes spreading her arms upon the arms of both the gentlemen's chairs, then throwing her arms carelessly upon the doctor's neck. I was highly disgusted, and never wished for an acquaintance with ladies of this caste. After dinner, she threw herself on a settee, where she showed more than her feet. She had a little lap dog, who was, next to the doctor, her favorite. This she kissed, and when he wet the floor, she wiped it up with her shirt. Franklin did more than flirt with Madame Helvétius. By September 1779 he was ardently proposing marriage in a way that was more than half serious, but retained enough ironic detachment to preserve their dignities. "If that lady likes to pass her days with him, he in turn would like to pass his nights with her," he wrote through Cabanis, using the third person. "As he has already given her many of his days, though he has so few left to give, she appears ungrateful never to have given him a single one of her nights, which steadily pass as a pure loss, without giving happiness to anyone except Poupon, her dog." She led him on lightly. "I hope that after putting such pretty things on paper," she scrawled, "you would come and tell me some." He continued his quest in a clever yet still humorously detached fashion by composing for her two little tales. The first was written in the voice of the flies living in his apartment. They complain about the dangers they faced from the spiders at Passy, and thank her for making him clean out their webs. "There only remains one thing for us to wish," they conclude. "It is to see both of you forming at last but one ménage." Turgot, now more jealous than amused by Franklin, counseled her to decline his marriage proposals, which she did. Franklin nevertheless renewed his suit with one of his most famous tales, The Elysian Fields, in which he recounted a dream about going to heaven and discussing the matter with her late husband and his late wife, who had themselves married. Praising Madame Helvétius's looks over those of his departed wife, he suggested they take revenge. "Vexed by your barbarous resolution, announced so positively last evening, to remain single all your life in respect to your dear husband, I went home, fell on my bed, and, believing myself dead, found myself in the Elysian fields. Monsieur Helvétius received me with great courtesy, having known me for some time, he said, by the reputation I had there. He asked me 1,000 things about the war, and about the present state of religion, liberty, and the government in France. You asked nothing then of your dear friend, Madame H. Nevertheless, she still loves you excessively, and I was at her place but an hour ago. Ah, said he, you make me remember my former felicity, but it is necessary to forget it in order to be happy here. During several of the early years, I thought only of her. Finally, I am consoled. I have taken another wife, the most like her that I could find. She is not, it is true, so completely beautiful, but she has as much good sense, a little more of spirit, and she loves me infinitely. Her continual study is to please me, and she has actually gone to hunt the best nectar and the best ambrosia in order to regale me this evening. Remain with me, and you will see her. At these words, the new Madame H. entered with the nectar, at which instant I recognized her to be Madame F., my old American friend. I reclaimed to her, but she told me coldly, I have been your good wife 49 years and 4 months, nearly a half century. Be content with that. Here I have formed a new connection, which will endure to eternity. Offended by this refusal of my Eurydice, I suddenly decided to leave these ungrateful spirits to return to the good earth, to see again the sunshine and you. Here I am. Let us revenge ourselves. Beneath the frivolity lurked a sincere desire. His friends thought so, as did his friendly rival Turgot. Yet it was expressed with a flair that made it seem safe and clever. Always uncomfortable with deep emotional bonds, Franklin performed the perfect distancing trick. Instead of conducting his suit in secret, which would have given it a dangerous seriousness, he took it public by publishing the story on his private press a few months later. By doing so, he put his heart out for all to see, and there it could dance safely in the realm between sincerity and self-deprecating playfulness. Franklin somehow never committed himself wholly in love, notes Claudin Lopez. A part of him was always holding back and watching the proceedings with irony. It was all too much, both the seriousness and the public playfulness, for Madame Helvétius. She fled in June 1780 to spend the summer in Tours with the hope, according to a letter Turgot wrote a mutual friend, that she may forget, if possible, all the turmoil that has tormented her. He added that the vacation was best not only for her own tranquillity, but also to re-establish it in that other head, that is Franklin's, that has agitated so ill-advisedly. As for Franklin, the deft dance of half-serious flirtations, unrequited though they were, had a rejuvenating effect on his body and spirit. "I do not find that I grow any older," he wrote a friend that spring. "Being arrived at 70, and considering that by traveling further in the same road I should probably be led to the grave, I stopped short, turned about, and walked back again, which, having done these 4 years, you may now call me 66. The Bagatelles. One product of Franklin's flirtations at Passy and Auteuil was the collection of fables and tales, such as the ephemera, the flies, and the Elysian fields mentioned above, that he wrote to amuse his friends. He called them bagatelles, the French term for a sprightly little musical piece, and he published many of them on the private press he installed at Passy. They were similar to little stories he had written in the past, such as The Trial of Polly Baker, but the dozen or so written in Passy have a slight French accent to them. They have been the subject of much critical fawning. "Franklin's bagatelles combine delight with moral truth," declares Alfred Owen Aldrich. "They are among the world's masterpieces of light literature." Not exactly. Their value lies more in the glimpse they give into Franklin's personality than in their literary merit, which is somewhat slight. They are jeu d'esprit, as fun as a five-finger exercise. Most display Franklin's typical wry self-awareness, though some are a bit heavy-handed in their attempt to teach a moral lesson. The most amusing is Dialogue Between the Gout and Mr. Franklin, a precursor to the old Alka-Seltzer commercial in which a man is berated by his stomach. When he was bedridden by the malady in October 1780, Madame Brion wrote him a poem, Le Sage et la Goutte, that implied that his malady was caused by his love for one pretty mistress, sometimes two, three, four. Among the lines, "Moderation, dear doctor," said the gout, "is no virtue for which you stand out. You like food, you like ladies' sweet talk. You play chess when you should walk." Franklin replied one midnight with a long and rollicking dialogue in which the gout chided him for his indulgences, and also because Franklin liked to be instructive, prescribed a course of exercise and fresh air. Mr. F. "Eh, oh, eh, what have I done to merit these cruel sufferings?" The gout. "Many things. You have ate and drank too freely, and too much indulged those legs of yours in their indolence." Mr. F. "Who is it that accuses me?" The gout. "It is I, even I, the gout." Mr. F. "What, my enemy in person?" The gout. "No, not your enemy." Mr. F. "I repeat it, my enemy. For you would not only torment my body to death, but ruin my good name. You reproach me as a glutton and a tippler. Now all the world that knows me will allow that I am neither the one nor the other." The gout. "The world may think as it pleases. It is always very complacent to itself, and sometimes to its friends. But I very well know that the quantity of meat and drink proper for a man who takes a reasonable degree of exercise would be too much for another who never takes any." If your situation in life is a sedentary one, your amusements, your recreation at least, should be active. You ought to walk or ride, or if the weather prevents that, play at billiards. But let us examine your course of life. While the mornings are long and you have leisure to go abroad, what do you do? Why, instead of gaining an appetite for breakfast by salutary exercise, you amuse yourself with books, pamphlets, or newspapers, which commonly are not worth the reading. Yet you eat an inordinate breakfast, 4 dishes of tea with cream, and 1 or 2 buttered toasts with slices of hung beef, which I fancy are not things the most easily digested. Immediately afterwards you sit down to write at your desk, or converse with persons who apply to you on business. Thus the time passes till 1, without any kind of bodily exercise. But all this I could pardon, in regard, as you say, to your sedentary condition. But what is your practice after dinner? Walking in the beautiful gardens of those friends with whom you have dined would be the choice of men of sense. Yours is to be fixed down to chess, where you are found engaged for 2 or 3 hours. You know Monsieur Brion's gardens, and what fine walks they contain. You know the handsome flight of 100 steps which lead from the terrace above to the lawn below. You have been in the practice of visiting this amiable family twice a week after dinner, and it is a maxim of your own that a man may take as much exercise in walking a mile up and down stairs as in 10 on level ground. What an opportunity was here for you to have had exercise in both these ways! Did you embrace it? And how often? Mr. F. I cannot immediately answer that question. The Gout. I will do it for you. Not once. He sent the bagatelle to Madame Brion, along with a letter that, in a cheeky way, rebutted her poem's contention that mistresses have had a share in producing this painful malady. As he pointed out, when I was a young man and enjoyed more of the favors of the fair sex than I do at present, I had no gout. Hence, if the ladies of Passy had shown more of that Christian charity that I have so often recommended to you in vain, I should not be suffering from the gout right now. Sex had become, by then, a topic of banter rather than of tension for them. I will do my best for you, in a spirit of Christian charity, she wrote back, but to the exclusion of your brand of Christian charity. Franklin used his bagatelles as a way to improve his language skills. He would translate them back and forth, show them to friends like the Abbé de la Roche, and then incorporate corrections. He wrote his famous story about paying too much for a whistle as a child, for example, in 2 columns, the left in French and the right in English, with space in the margins for revisions. Because Madame Brion spoke no English, Franklin sent her the French versions of his writings, often showing her the corrections others had made. She was looser about grammar than about morals. "The corrector of your French spoiled your work," she said of the edits La Roche made to the Gout dialogue. "Leave your works as they are. Use words that say things, and laugh at grammarians, who by their purity weaken all your sentences." For example, Franklin often coined new French words, such as indulger, meaning to indulge, which his friends would then revise. Madame Brion, however, found these neologisms charming. "A few purists might quibble with us, because those birds weigh words on a scale of cold erudition," she wrote. "But since you seem to express yourself more forcefully than a grammarian, my judgment goes in your favor." Franklin found it particularly difficult to master the language's masculine and feminine distinctions, and he even jokingly put the word masculine in the feminine form and féminine in the masculine when complaining about the need to look such things up in the dictionary. "For 60 years now, since age 16, masculine and feminine things, and I am not talking about modes and tenses, have been giving me a lot of trouble," he noted wryly. "It will make me all the happier to go to paradise where they say all such distinctions will be abolished." So how good was Franklin's French? By 1780 he was speaking and writing with great flourish and gusto, though not always with proper pronunciation and grammar. That approach appealed to most of his friends there, particularly the women. But, not surprisingly, it offended John Adams. "Dr. Franklin is reported to speak French very well, but I find upon attending to him critically that he does not speak it grammatically," Adams chided. He acknowledged to me that he was wholly inattentive to grammar. His pronunciation, too, upon which the French gentlemen and ladies complimented him very highly, and which he seemed to think pretty well, I soon found out was very inaccurate. The bagatelle that most enchanted his French friends, entitled Con, was a parable about religious tolerance. A French officer who is about to die recounts a dream in which he arrives at the gates of heaven and watches St. Peter ask people about their religion. The first replies that he is a Catholic, and St. Peter says, "Take your place there among the Catholics." A similar procedure follows for an Anglican and a Quaker. When the officer confesses that he has no religion, St. Peter is indulgent. "You can come in anyway, just find a place for yourself wherever you can." Franklin seems to have revised the manuscript a few times to make his point about tolerance clear, and in one version expressed it more forcefully as, "Enter anyway and take any place you wish." The tale echoed many of Franklin's previous light writings advocating religious tolerance. Although Franklin's belief in a benevolent God was becoming stronger as he grew older, the French intellectuals admired the fact that he did not embrace any religious sect. "Our free thinkers have adroitly sounded him on his religion," one acquaintance wrote, "and they maintain that they have discovered he is one of their own. That is, that he had none at all." Chess and Farts. One of Franklin's famous passions was chess, as evidenced by the late-night match he played in Madame Brion's bathroom. He saw the game as a metaphor for both diplomacy and life, a point that he made explicit in a bagatelle he wrote in 1779 on The Morals of Chess, which was based on an essay he had drafted in 1732 for his Philadelphia Junto. "The game of chess is not merely an idle amusement," he began. "Several very valuable qualities of the mind, useful in the course of human life, are to be acquired or strengthened by it. For life is a kind of chess, in which we have often points to gain and competitors or adversaries to contend with." Chess, he said, taught foresight, circumspection, caution, and the importance of not being discouraged. There was also an important etiquette to be practiced. Never hurry your opponent. Do not try to deceive by pretending to have made a bad move, and never gloat in victory. Moderate your desire of victory over your adversary, and be pleased with the one over yourself. There were even times when it was prudent to let an opponent retract a bad move. You may indeed happen to lose the game to your opponent, but you will win what is better, his esteem. During one of Franklin's late-night chess matches in Passy, a messenger arrived with an important set of dispatches from America. Franklin waved him off until the game was finished. Another time he was playing with his equal, the Duchess of Bourbon, who made a move that inadvertently exposed her king. Ignoring the rules of the game, he promptly captured it. "Ah," said the Duchess, "we do not take kings so," replied Franklin in a famous quip, "we do in America." One night in Passy he was absorbed in a game when the candles flickered out. Refusing to quit, he sent his opponent to find more. The man quickly returned with a surprised look and the news that it was already light outside. Franklin threw open the shutters. "You are right. It is daytime," he said. "Let's go to bed." The incident was the inspiration for a bagatelle he wrote about his surprise at discovering that the sun rose and poured forth light at 6 in the morning. By this stage in his life, it should be noted, he no longer shared poor Richard's belief in being early to bed and early to rise. He declared that this discovery would surprise his readers, who, with me, have never seen any signs of sunshine before noon. This led him to conclude that if people would simply get up much earlier, they could save a lot of money on candles. He even included some pseudo-scientific calculations of what could be saved by this economical project if, during the summer months, Parisians would shift their sleeping time 7 hours earlier. Close to 97 million livres, an immense sum that the city of Paris might save every year by the economy of using sunshine instead of candles. Franklin concluded by bestowing the idea on the public without any request for royalty or reward. "I expect only to have the honor of it," he declared. He ended up with far more honor than he could have imagined. Most histories of the invention of daylight savings time credit the idea to this essay by Franklin, even though he wrote it mockingly and did not come up with the idea of actually shifting clocks by an hour during the summer. The essay, which parodied both human habits and scientific treatises, reflected, as did his writings as a youth, the influence of Jonathan Swift. It was the type of irony Swift would have written in place of A Modest Proposal if he had spent 5 years in the company of Madames Helvétius and Brion, notes Alfred Owen Aldridge. A similar scientific spoof, even more fun and famous, or perhaps notorious, was the mock proposal he made to the Royal Academy of Brussels that they study the causes and cures of farting. Noting that the Academy's leaders, in soliciting questions to study, claimed to esteem utility, he suggested a serious inquiry that would be worthy of this enlightened age. "It is universally well known that in digesting our common food, there is created or produced in the bowels of human creatures a great quantity of wind. That the permitting this air to escape and mix with the atmosphere is usually offensive to the company from the fetid smell that accompanies it. That all well-bred people, therefore, to avoid giving such offense, forcibly restrain the efforts of nature to discharge that wind. That so retained, contrary to nature, it not only gives frequently great present pain, but occasions future diseases. Were it not for the odiously offensive smell accompanying such escapes, polite people would probably be under no more restraint in discharging such wind in company than they are in spitting or in blowing their noses. My prized question, therefore, should be to discover some drug, wholesome and not disagreeable, to be mixed with our common food or sauces, that shall render the natural discharges of wind from our bodies not only inoffensive, but agreeable as perfumes." With a pretense of scientific seriousness, Franklin proceeded to explain how different foods and minerals change the odor of farts. Might not a mineral such as lime work to make the smell pleasant? "This is worth the experiment. There would be immortal honor attached to whoever made the discovery," he argued, "for it would be far more useful than those discoveries in science that have heretofore made philosophers famous. All the works of Aristotle and Newton," he noted, "do little to help those plagued by gas. What comfort can the vortices of Descartes give to a man who has whirlwinds in his bowels? The invention of a fart perfume would allow hosts to pass wind freely with the comfort that it would give pleasure to their guests. Compared to this luxury, he said with a bad pun, previous discoveries are altogether scarcely worth a farthing. Although he printed this farce privately at his press in Passy, Franklin apparently had qualms and never released it publicly. He did, however, send it to friends, and he noted in particular that it might be of interest to one of them, the famous chemist and gas specialist Joseph Priestley, who is apt to give himself airs. Yet another delightful essay of mock science was written as a letter to the Abbé Morellet. It celebrated the wonders of wine and the glories of the human elbow. We hear of the conversion of water into wine at the marriage in Cana as a miracle. But this conversion is through the goodness of God made every day before our eyes. Behold the rain which descends from heaven upon our vineyards. There it enters the roots of the vines to be changed into wine, a constant proof that God loves us and loves to see us happy. The miracle in question was performed only to hasten the operation. As for the human elbow, Franklin explained, it was important that it be located at the right place. Otherwise, it would be hard to drink wine. If Providence had placed the elbow too low on the arm, it would be hard for the forearm to reach the mouth. Likewise, if the elbow had been placed too high, the forearm would overshoot the mouth. But by the actual situation, we are enabled to drink at our ease, the glass going exactly to the mouth. Let us then with glass in hand adore this benevolent wisdom. Let us adore and drink. Family Matters. Where did this new circle of ersatz family members leave Franklin's actual family? At a distance. His daughter Sally, who adored him, wrote of her diligence in restoring their house in Philadelphia after the British had withdrawn in May 1778. But whereas the letters from his French lady friends began, "Cher Papa," most of those from his real daughter began more stiffly, with, "Dear and honored sir." His replies, addressed to, "Dear Sally," and occasionally, "My dear child," often expressed delight about the exploits of his grandchildren. But sometimes even his compliments were freighted with exhortations. "If you knew how happy your letters make me," he lectured at one point, "I think you would write oftener." In early 1779, Sally wrote of the high price of goods in America and how she was busy spinning her own tablecloths. Unfortunately, however, she made the mistake of adding that she had been invited to a ball in honor of General Washington and had sent to France for pins, lace, and feathers so she could look fashionable. "There never was so much dressing and pleasure going on," she exulted to her father, and she added that she hoped he would send her some accessories so that she could take pride in showing off his taste. At the time, Franklin was writing his sweet bagatelles to his French friends and promising Polly Stevenson a pair of diamond earrings if one of his lottery tickets won. But he responded with dismay at Sally's plea for a few luxuries. "Your sending for long black pins and lace and feathers disgusted me as much as if you had put salt in my strawberries," he chided. "The spinning, I see, is laid aside, and you are to be dressed for the ball. You seem not to know, my dear daughter, that of all the dear things in this world, idleness is the dearest." He sent her some of the items she had requested that are useful and necessary, but added a dose of homespun advice with just a touch of his humor about the frivolous fineries. If you wear your cambric ruffles, as I do, and take care not to mend the holes, they will come in time to be lace. And feathers, my dear girl, may be had in America from every cock's tail." Clearly hurt, she replied with a detailed description of how industrious and frugal she was being, and she tried to work back into his graces by sending over some homespun American silk for him to present from her to Queen Marie Antoinette. Knowing her father's desire to promote the local silk industry, she noted, "It will show what can be sent from America." It was a sweet gesture. With all the elements, industriousness, selflessness, promotion of American products, gratitude toward France, that should have appealed to Franklin. Alas, the silk was stained by salt water on the way over, and worse yet, her father scoffed at the entire scheme. "I wonder how, having yourself scarce shoes to your feet, it would come into your head to give clothes to a queen," he wrote back. "I shall see if the stains can be covered by dyeing it and making summer suits of it for myself, Temple, and Benny." He did, however, end on a kinder and gentler note. "All the things you order will be sent, for you continue to be a good girl and spin and knit your family stockings." Franklin's heart proved far softer when it came to news about his grandchildren. In late 1779, Sally had a fourth child, and in hopes of pleasing Franklin, baptized the boy Louis, after the French king. The name was so unusual in America that people had to inquire whether the child was a boy or girl. When her son Willie recited the Lord's Prayer after a nightmare and addressed it to Hercules, she asked her father for his advice. "Whether it is best to instruct him in a little religion, or let him pray a little longer to Hercules?" Franklin replied with a hint of humor that she should teach him to direct his worship more properly, for the deity of Hercules is now quite out of fashion. Sally complied. A little later she wrote that Willie was learning his Bible well, and that he had an extraordinary memory for all literature. "He has learned the speech of Anthony over Caesar's body, which he can scarcely speak without tears." Her daughter, Elizabeth, she added, was fond of looking at the picture of her grandfather, and has frequently tried to tempt you to walk out of the frame to play with her with a piece of apple pie, the thing of all others she likes best. Sally also found a project that enabled her to earn Franklin's unvarnished approval. With Washington's army suffering in tattered uniforms in December 1779, she rallied the women of Philadelphia to raise donations, buy cloth, and sew more than 2,000 shirts for the beleaguered troops. "I am very busily employed in cutting out and making shirts for our brave soldiers," she reported. When Washington tried to pay cash for even more shirts, the ladies refused it and kept working for free. "I hope you will approve of what we have done," she wrote, clearly fishing for an expression of praise. Franklin, of course, did approve. He wrote back commending her for her amor patrii, and he had an account of her activities published in France. Her son Benny also felt the vagaries of Franklin's affection. Even though the boy had been snatched from the bosom of the Bache family to accompany him to Europe, after 2 years at a boarding school near Passy, where he saw his grandfather but once a week, the quiet 9-year-old was packed off to an academy in Geneva, where he would not see him for more than 4 years. Despite his love of the French, Franklin felt that a Catholic monarchy was not the best place to educate his grandson, he wrote Sally, "as I intend him for a Presbyterian as well as a Republican." Benny was taken to Geneva by a French diplomat, Philibert Cramer, who was a publisher of Voltaire. Hungry as ever for affection and a father figure, Benny latched on to Cromer, who died suddenly a few months later. So he lived for a while with Cromer's widow, Catherine, and then was left in the charge of Gabriel Louis de Marignac, a former poet and military officer who ran the academy. Horribly lonely, Benny begged that his brother William, or his former Passy classmate John Quincy Adams, be sent to join him. At the very least, could he please have a picture of Franklin and some news? Franklin, ever willing to send out his portrait, obliged with one, along with the news of Sally's success in supplying shirts to Washington's troops. "Be diligent in your studies, that you also may be qualified to do service to your country and be worthy of so good a mother," he wrote. He also sent word that four of Benny's former Passy schoolmates had died of smallpox, and he should be thankful he had been inoculated as a child. Yet even his expressions of affection contained a note of contingency. "I shall always love you very much if you continue to be a good boy," he closed one letter. Benny did well his first year, and even won the school prize for translating Latin into French. Franklin sent him some money so that he could host the celebration the prize winner traditionally gave for his classmates. He also asked Polly Stevenson, still in London, to pick out some books for Benny in English, as he was showing signs of losing that language. Polly, knowing how to flatter her friend, picked out a book that included mentions of Franklin. But Benny eventually fell into the funk of a depressed adolescent, perhaps because Franklin never visited nor did Temple, nor was he brought back to Passy for vacations. He turned shy and indolent, reported Madame Cromer, who continued to keep an eye on him. "He has an excellent heart. He is sensible, reasonable. He is serious, but he has neither gaiety nor vivacity. He is cold. He has few needs, no fantasies. He didn't play cards, never got in fights, and showed no signs that he would ever display great talents or passions." In this prediction, she was wrong, for in later life, Benny would become a crusading newspaper editor. When she reminded Benny that he had won the Latin prize and was clearly capable of being a good student, he answered coldly that it had been sheer luck, she wrote Franklin. And when she offered to request for him a larger allowance from his grandfather, he showed no interest. Benny's parents became worried, and Richard Bache timidly suggested that perhaps Franklin could find time to go see him. "It would give us pleasure to hear that you had found leisure enough to visit him at Geneva," Bache wrote, noting that the journey might conduce to your health. But it was a tentative suggestion made almost apologetically. "I suspect your time has been more importantly employed," he quickly added. Madame Cromer, for her part, suggested that, at the very least, he could write Benny more frequently. Franklin did not find time to travel to Geneva, but he did compose for him one of his didactic little essays that proclaimed the virtues of education and diligence. "Those who study hard," he wrote, "live comfortably in good houses, whereas those who are idle and neglect their schoolwork are poor and dirty and ragged and ignorant and vicious and live in miserable cabins and garrets." Franklin liked the lesson so much that he made a copy and sent it to Sally, who gushed that Willie shall get it by heart. Benny, on the other hand, did not even acknowledge receiving it. So Franklin sent him another copy, and ordered him to translate it into French and send it back to assure he understood it. Finally, Benny found a friend who brought him out of his torpor. Samuel Johonnet, the grandson of Franklin's Boston friend, the Reverend Samuel Cooper, A turbulent and factious lad, he was expelled from the school in Passy, and Franklin arranged to send him to the Geneva Academy. He was a smart student, placing first in the class and spurring Benny to come in a respectable third. Socially, Jehanette's effect on Benny was even more pronounced. He began to develop more of his family's rebellious streak. At one point, a cat killed one of their pet guinea pigs, and they resolved to kill a cat, any cat, in revenge, which they did. Benny went to his first dance, which unnerved him so much that he was relieved when a fire across the street brought it to an abrupt end. But then he went to another dance, and a third, where he enjoyed himself thoroughly. He wrote to his grandfather that he was now having fun, told of his butterfly hunting and grape harvesting expeditions, and was even so bold to hint that he would, after all, like a larger allowance. That and a watch, a good golden one. It would be practical, he assured his grandfather, and he promised to take good care of it. Franklin responded the way he had to Sally's request for lace and feathers. "I cannot afford to give gold watches to children," he wrote. "You should not tease me for expensive things that can be of little or no service to you." He was also appalled when young Jehanette asked that he and Benny be allowed to come back to Paris. That elicited another stern admonition sent to Jehanette, but directed at both boys. "It is time for you to think of establishing a character for manly steadiness." It was an injunction that should have been addressed to his other grandson, Temple, who had gone to France to continue his own education, but had neither enrolled in a college nor taken a course. Temple's work for the American delegation was competent enough, but he spent most of his time hunting, riding, partying, and chasing women. Hoping to help him settle down with both a dowry and a job, Franklin proposed a marriage between his roguish grandson and the Brion's elder daughter, Cunégonde. This was nothing new. An incorrigible but never successful matchmaker, Franklin was incessantly trying, usually with ironic half-seriousness, to marry off his children and grandchildren to those of his friends. This time, however, he was wholly serious, indeed earnestly plaintive. His letter, making the formal proposal, awkwardly written in a French that was uncorrected by his friends, declared that Madame Brion was a daughter to him, and expressed hope that her daughter would become one as well. He said that Temple, whom the Brions called Franklinet, had agreed to the proposal, especially after Franklin promised to remain in France until the end of my days if the marriage took place. After repeating his desire to have children nearby, to close my eyes when I die, he went on to extol the virtues of Temple, who has no vices, and has what it takes to become in time a distinguished man. Knowing Temple well, the Brions may not have fully agreed with that assessment. They certainly did not agree to the marriage proposal. The main excuse they gave was that Temple was not a Catholic. That gave Franklin an opening to write, as he had often done before, about the need for religious tolerance and how all religions had at their core the same basic principles. Among the five he listed in his letter was his own oft-stated religious credo, "The best service to God is doing good to men." Madame Brion agreed in her reply that there is only one religion and one morality. Nevertheless, she and her husband refused to assent to the marriage. "We are obliged to submit to the customs of our country," she said. Monsieur Brion was looking to retire from his position as a tax receiver general and wanted a son-in-law who could succeed him. "This position is the most important of our assets," she wrote, ignoring that she had frequently complained to Franklin that she was trapped in an arranged marriage made for financial reasons. "It calls for a man who knows the laws and customs of our country, a man of our religion." Franklin realized that Monsieur Brion's objections might be caused by something more than merely Temple's religion. "There may be other objections he has not communicated to me," he wrote Madame Brion, "and I ought not to give him trouble." For his part, Temple embarked on a year-long series of affairs with women high and low, including a French countess and an Italian, until suddenly falling in love, albeit briefly, with the Brion's younger daughter, who was only 15. This time, Monsieur Brion seemed ready to approve of the alliance, and even offered a job and dowry. But the fickle Temple had already moved on to other women, including a married mistress, who would eventually end up making him the third generation of Franklins to bear an illegitimate son. Chapter 15. Peacemaker. Paris, 1778 through 1785. Minister Plenipotentiary. By the summer of 1778, it had become clear to all three American commissioners that there should be only one person in charge. Not only was it difficult for the three of them to agree on policies, Franklin told the Congress, but it was now even difficult for them to work in the same house together. Even their servants were quarreling. In addition, the French had appointed a minister plenipotentiary to America, and protocol demanded that the new nation reciprocate with an appointee of similar rank. Arthur Lee nominated himself and conspired with his brothers to win the prize. John Adams more graciously suggested to friends that Franklin, despite his work habits and softness toward France, would be best. Franklin did not overtly push for the job, but he did strongly ask the Congress in July 1778 to separate us. The French did Franklin's lobbying for him. They let it be known that he was their choice, and the Congress complied in September by electing him the sole minister plenipotentiary. The vote was 12-1, the dissenting state being Pennsylvania, where his enemies questioned his loyalty and that of his grandson Temple, the son of an imprisoned loyalist governor. Word of his appointment did not reach Paris until February 1779, for the war and the winter hindered the passage of American ships. When it did, Arthur Lee sulked and refused to hand over his papers to Franklin. As for Adams, his biographer David McCullough writes, "The new arrangement was exactly what Adams had recommended, and the news was to leave him feeling more miserable than ever." He soon left Paris, at least for the time being, to make his way back to Massachusetts. Franklin was suffering from the gout and could not immediately present his new credentials, but in late March he paid a call on the king and his ministers. Mindful of Adams's hurt feelings, Franklin worked to keep their relationship cordial. He wrote Adams a polite and amusing letter, in which he described his rounds at Versailles and complained that "the fatigue, however, was a little too much for my feet and disabled me for near another week." In his own letters, Adams kept up a collegial facade, and he even expressed some support for Franklin's deep fealty to the French, despite his own doubts about the wisdom of becoming too aligned with them. "I am much pleased with your reception at court in the new character," he replied, "and I do not doubt that your opinion of the goodwill of this court to the United States is just." Adams's fragile equanimity was shaken, however, when Franklin and the French decided to commandeer the ship that was supposed to take him home and assign it to be part of the fleet that John Paul Jones planned to use against the British, of which more later. Well aware that Adams was impatiently waiting at the port of Nantes to set sail, Franklin was apologetic, and he even got the powerful French naval minister, Antoine de Sartine, to write a letter explaining the decision. Another ship would be assigned to take him home as soon as feasible, Franklin promised, and it would allow Adams the benefit of traveling with the new French minister to the United States. Adams pretended to be understanding. "The public service must not be obstructed for the private convenience of an individual, and the honor of a passage with the new ambassador should be a compensation to me for the loss of the prospect of so speedy a return home." Showing just a touch of the polite hypocrisy that he was generally famed for lacking, Adams even went so far as to ask Franklin to "oblige me much by making my compliments to Madame Brion and Madame Helvétius, ladies for whose characters I have a great respect." But as he brooded in port, Adams became increasingly bitter. After dining with Jones, he declared that the captain was a man of eccentricities and irregularities, and he grew furious at the thought that Jones and Franklin were conspiring to delay his trip home. "It is decreed that I shall endure all sorts of mortifications," he wrote in his diary. "Do I see that these people despise me, or do I see that they dread me?" Inevitably, he began to ascribe dark motives to Franklin. Simmering in self-importance, Adams began to suspect that Franklin was hindering his return home because he feared the dangerous truths he might reveal. "Does the old conjurer dread my voice in Congress?" Adams wrote in his diary. "He had some reason, for he has often heard it there, a terror to evildoers." Franklin was blithely oblivious of Adams's dark suspicions, and he carried on trying to be cordial in his letters. "I shall take care to present your respects to the good ladies you mention," he cheerfully promised.